Good evening, it's Sunday, January 17th, 2021. Coming up, on the eve of Martin Luther King Jr. Day, people across the country are still fighting for justice. Wanda Johnson, the mother of the late Oscar Grant, is slated to return to the Alameda County District Attorney's Office tomorrow. She says she's hopeful that the DA has had a change of heart about charging Officer Peroni in her son's death.
Justice would be for me to have my son here, but for the other officer to be charged would be another measure of justice.
Organizers in Alabama continue to fight for justice for the state's incarcerated and formerly incarcerated population with the backing of a Department of Justice lawsuit.
It specifically asks for the Department of Corrections to come in compliance with the 8th and the 14th Amendment.
And as the country is days away from the inauguration of President-elect Joe Biden, demands continue for President Trump to be held fully accountable for his role in inciting an insurrection on January 6th.
He needs to be convicted. We need to ensure that he can never come back to elected office again. And even more, it would be a real setback to the whole fascist movement that he leads.
I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. Martin Luther King Jr. once said that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Decades later, the fight for racial justice continues across the country in spaces ranging from the streets to voting poll stations to the prison system. Pastor Kenneth Glasgow is with the Ordinary People Society and is based in Alabama. After serving nearly a decade and a half in prison, he has dedicated his life to helping incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people access everything from humane treatment to basic rights. Glasgow says he's heartened that the Department of Justice took note of injustice in Alabama prisons by filing a lawsuit last month. The suit is against the state of Alabama and the Alabama Department of Corrections. It alleges failure to protect the incarcerated population from prisoner-to-prisoner violence and sexual abuse, failure to provide safe and sanitary conditions, and failure to protect incarcerated people from excessive force from prison staff.
There's a lawsuit from the Department of Justice against the Alabama Department of Corrections because of their violation of the 8th and the 14th Amendment, their inhumane treatment against those that are incarcerated. We don't call them inmates. We don't use the words ex-felons, ex-convicts, and ex-offenders because that's just like calling me the N-word. And a lot of people say, well, how does that call you the N-word? That's not racism. Well, it may not be racism, but it's classism. Same hurt, same pain, same effects. And so the Department of Justice, under a Republican rule, might I add, sued the reddest Republican state in the country, Alabama, because of their egregious and horrific treatment of those incarcerated. Now, let me remind you, this is an ongoing investigation that comes from President Barack Obama's tenure when he was in office, where I have delivered the complaints.
Can you talk about the timeline for this lawsuit and then what is it specifically asking for?
It specifically asks for the Department of Corrections to come in compliance with the 8th and the 14th Amendment. It specifically asks for the Department of Corrections to stop its egregious acts in violations of violence and mistreatment of those that are incarcerated. It's asking for the Department of Corrections to become adequate in their management, and especially in their care, custody, control, and to prevent the deaths that's occurring inside the Department of Corrections.
So you mentioned 32 deaths. Was that within one prison or was that within the Alabama prison system?
That's in the Alabama prison system. But those are the only ones that we have recorded.
How hopeful are you that the change in administration might have an impact on such things as the prison system in Alabama?
I'm looking forward to it. I'm actually looking forward to the fact that Biden and Harris are where they are. We had the chance to meet with Kamala Harris herself. At our forum, we had a presidential forum, formerly incarcerated people then, and Pennsylvania, at the first prison that was ever built up there. And during that forum, we asked her tough questions about what would she do if she become president at that particular time, and how would she help build a task force that would not only look at the police brutality, you know, but the treatment of those in prisons and in jails as well. And she gave us her word that this is something she would look at and reminded us of what she had did as Attorney General in California. From what I'm hearing from my brother, Reverend Al Sharpton, and other national leaders, that is exactly where she's at.
He says Biden's support of the 1994 crime law or Harris's tough-on-crime stance from her early political career is less important than where they stand today. Glasgow, who lives by the motto of being a second-chance citizen, not a second-class citizen, says it's important that lawmakers like Biden and Harris have a chance to redeem themselves.
Biden said in his debate, he regrets some of the things he did with the 1994 prison bill, and he will remand some of that stuff and look back at it. And that's what they're doing. So we're going to hold their feet to the fire. But, when people are doing the right thing, you really don't have to hold their feet to the fire. You just have to join them and walk with them.
It's interesting for both of these candidates, right? Biden had the 94 policy that you talked about. Harris was known as being tough on crime. And it sounds like they've really adjusted their positions as time has gone. And yet some people are pretty unforgiving for those older systems that they helped implement. What's your take on that piece?
I've done some things wrong in my life. And my thing is, are you going to look at what I'm doing now, or are you going to continue to look at my past? A lot of people don't get that chance. A lot of people don't live that long. But if a person have a chance to redeem themselves from a mistake that they made or see that they made or whatever, just like Hillary Clinton. When she implemented that No Child Left Behind, she said she had no idea it was going to affect so many minority children the way it did. But now she wants to go back and correct that. So Biden wants to go back and correct that. Kamala Harris wants to go back and correct that. All of us live in a life of learning. Our experience teaches us. Our maturity grows us. And as we grow, there are changes that we will have in our mentality that we did not have as we were younger.
That's Pastor Kenneth Glasgow from the Ordinary People Society. On Martin Luther King Jr. Day, Wanda Johnson, the mother of the late Oscar Grant, and other members of the Oscar Grant Foundation will be meeting with the Alameda County District Attorney again, asking that she rethink her recent decision not to charge Officer Anthony Peroni for the killing of the late Oscar Grant, who died in police custody on January 1, 2009. While Johannes Messerli fired the fatal shot, Johnson believes that Peroni's conduct escalated tensions and contributed to her son Oscar's death. Johnson says she was surprised to learn that the presiding Alameda County District Attorney had announced to the press before meeting with Johnson and other members of the Oscar Grant Foundation her initial decision not to charge Officer Anthony Peroni. Citing portions of the fact-finding document, Johnson says she is simply not satisfied.
The law makes clear that Anthony Peroni can be guilty of murder only if he personally killed Mr. Grant, which we know that was not true, because many times people are found guilty of murder and they were just there at the scene. And so we know that part of her statement was not true. So then she went and said, in fact, neither Peroni killed nor aided and abetted Messerli, who actually killed Mr. Grant. Well, in a sense, he did aid and abet. And the reason why is because he actually initiated the whole scene. Instead of him being the officer who was first on site, the one who supposed to be in command at that time, he failed to do that. And Oscar ended up losing his life. In the meeting, we posed her to go back and look at the evidence and think about it before she made a decision. But one of the things that we did not know is that she had already had her press conference and she had already provided them with these documents.
So that puts you in a really tough position, because now she's publicly stated this and it's been on all the media outlets, right? Like, Officer Peroni will not be charged. And so what do you make of that? I mean, of course, we can't read her mind, but why do you imagine that she kind of put the cart in front of the horse and made this mass announcement prior to your knowledge of it even?
Well, I think part of her thing was that this was a political stunt for her anyway. What doesn't make it look good is that she put this fact-finding out and did not wait until she met with the family. And then now she may have to recant after we meet on the 18th.
So let's talk about the two scenarios. Let's say that you get good news. Maybe she can't charge on that particular murder charge, but let's say it's even second degree or third degree murder. Some level of accountability. How will you feel after that meeting, if that's the outcome? And then we'll talk about the other scenario as well.
I would feel very good. I would feel that she is doing what she knows should have been done a long time ago. I would feel a measure of justice. Justice would be for me to have my son here, but for the other officer to be charged would be another measure of justice that I definitely believe that my family and I should have.
And the other scenario, which might be, let's just say that she was calling you in to explain further why she made this decision, and how will you receive that? And then how will you move forward?
If she says that, we're going to have this case tried by the public, meaning that we're still going to put the pressure on. We're still going to have protests go forward. We will still have press conferences. We will still have people in the public trying this case.
Johnson says it's fitting that this meeting regarding potential justice for her late son is happening on Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
African-American people have been fighting for many, many years to be treated equally. And we know that our liberty is imbalanced. We just saw what happened in Washington, D.C., and how a building that's secure with police and security guards, how people was able to just break windows, get right through, go into Democrats and Republicans' office and throw fouls all over the floor. And yet we've seen the officers have a great amount of self-control and not do anything. And yet we have many African-American men by themselves running away from the police, and yet they end up losing their lives. It's significant because Martin Luther King fought for so many years trying to get our people to be treated equally. You know, he spoke of having that dream that one day Black children and white children will hold hands. And yes, that is a reality right now, but we're still fighting for equal rights, equal opportunity, and to be treated equally in our judicial system.
That's Wanda Johnson, the mother of the late Oscar Grant and the founder of the Oscar Grant Foundation. You're listening to KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, K248BR 97.5 FM in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Sharon Sabota. Many are saying that the pro-Trump mob that attacked the Capitol of the United States earlier this month is evidence that fascism is alive and well in the United States. President Trump became the first U.S. president to be impeached twice, most recently for incitement of insurrection. KPFA's Rhoda Lynn Ginto spoke with Samantha Goldman from RefuseFascism.org about the implications of President Trump's actions.
Some scholars and activists say that the pattern of events that has unfolded in the past 4 years is evidence that history does repeat itself and that there are still many lessons to be learned. Historian Robert O. Paxton, in his book, The Anatomy of Fascism, says fascism is a political behavior that brings together different groups of angry, discontented extremists to work together. Fascists form alliances with existing elite groups and individuals, and they spin messages about community decline, humiliation, and victimhood to persuade ordinary people to commit violent acts or, at the least, not resist them. Samantha Goldman of Refuse Fascism says President Trump's actions are a modern-day example of fascism. She says he must be held fully accountable for inciting the January 6th insurrection that led to 5 deaths, many injuries, and damage of the National Capitol. She says it's vital that his impeachment trial must proceed even if he's no longer in office.
He needs to be decisively repudiated. He needs to be impeached. He needs to be convicted. We need to ensure that he can never come back to elected office again. And even more, it would be a real setback to the whole fascist movement that he leads. People across the country need to demand this removal from power of Trump and the whole fascist crew in power, from Pence to the senators and representatives in Congress and the fascist legislators who all called for the coup in the 50 states. This fascist movement has been allowed to fester and strengthen, and their failed coup could become a successful one or come to power again and be legitimate. And it could be and would be fueled by the same fascist program, but with a vengeance.
Goldman is among the tens of thousands of people who have signed a pledge to reject fascism via the group's website. But she says these numbers aren't enough. Tens of thousands of pledges need to become 81 million pledges. Referencing the number of voters who cast their ballots in November's presidential election to deny President Trump a second term.
You had people in the halls of power speaking up this week, and that was important. It was important that Cori Bush called Trump a white supremacist in chief. It was important that Maxine Waters spoke to the danger of Trump still calling for a civil war. But if the millions of people who desire a just world fail to organize and pledge to not allow a fascist America, we're leaving a clear field for the fascist forces to advance. It's not enough to wait and hope and rely on those in power. We have a role and responsibility to play too.
For any form of healing to occur, justice must be served, says Goldman. If we want our future to be better, more people must continue to sound the alarm and stand up to fascists. Here's Goldman reading an excerpt of their pledge. It's also accessible at refusefascism.org.
We do not comply with the regime putting targets on the backs of Black, Brown, and Native people, denying women control of their bodies, forcing LGBTQ people back into the closet. We do not accept a society ruled by hate and bigotry, ignorance and brutality, demeaning and cursing other peoples and countries and threatening them with destruction. There can be no more children torn from their parents and locked in cages, no more fire and fury from the mouth of a demented bully with his finger on the nuclear trigger, no more mass COVID death from science-hating lunacy, no more law and order of official terror by bullets, batons, and tear gas. No longer can we live with howling mobs resurrecting Jim Crow, fascist thugs attacking our protests, the right to vote stolen by defenders of the Confederacy.
For KPFA and Pacifica Radio, this is Rodolyn Ginto.
Ugandans went to the polls to elect a president this week. Yoweri Museveni, who had held a tight grip on power in Uganda for 36 years, claims to have won, but his popular challenger, 38-year-old pop star-turned-politician Bobi Wine, claims election fraud. Museveni is now holding Wine and his wife under house arrest in their own home. KPFA's Ann Garrison has more.
Milton Alamadi, do you have any doubt that Bobi Wine is Uganda's choice and that he would have won the presidency this week if it had been an honest election?
I have no doubt that he's Uganda's choice. I have no doubt that he did win the election. It's only the fraudulent results that have been announced by the Election Commission, which is handpicked by General Yoweri Museveni.
We saw huge crowds turning out for Bobi Wine, even as his guards and media traveling with him were shot. Could you say anything about that?
Of course, absolutely. These are the folks, the young folks that he'd signed up. He had a national voter registration drive, and he added millions of young new voters to the voting roll. Who in the world believes that he's going to go out there and register all these millions of new voters and that at the end of the day, these young folks are going to end up voting for this 76-year-old dictator? It is so illogical and ludicrous. Everybody knows Bobi Wine won. Even General Museveni's Western supporters know Bobi Wine won. And if you read carefully between the lines, when the U.S. State Department starts saying this was a fundamentally flawed election, translation, these elections were not credible, not transparent, and will not be acceptable.
We should add here that 3/4 of Uganda's population are under 30 years old with very few prospects under Museveni, right?
Absolutely. And Bobi Wine is 38 years old. So you have a situation where 80% of the population is under the age of 35. You have also an unemployment rate of 80%. Why would anyone vote for General Museveni?
Okay. Troops from Uganda and Burundi have been part of AMISOM, an African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia, which is in fact managed by the Pentagon. Horace Campbell, professor at Syracuse University, was on these airways earlier this week, and he said that the conflict in Somalia was manufactured by the U.S., that the U.S. has funded terrorists in Somalia, as in so many other countries, and that Ugandan soldiers have been proven to be selling them arms. Bobi Wine has said in interviews, television interviews, that he will sustain the Ugandan troop support. I don't know whether Horace Campbell's heard him say that, but either way, I'm sure he agrees with you that Bobi Wine should end tyranny of Yoweri Museveni. Now, some leftists, Western leftists, are alarmed by this support for a clearly imperial project, imperial and profoundly dishonest, and other soft power support that Bobi Wine has in the West. But I don't think there's any way Bobi Wine would have gotten this far if he described the Somali conflict, as Horace Campbell did, whether he knows it or not.
Absolutely. Bobby Wine, on the contrary, has said the problem with the Somalia intervention is that it's a purely Museveni project, and that in order to actually resolve the crisis in Somalia, to stabilize Somalia, and to create a peaceful Somalia, is to get an authentic multi-African project involved. So, for example, it would not just be soldiers from Uganda. We have to get other major African countries involved. For example, South Africa, Ghana, Nigeria, Senegal. If you have a multi-Africa military force, the people of Somalia would be able to understand that this is indeed an authentic operation to help the people of Somalia. But right now, as the Ugandan soldiers in large segments of Somalia are seen as an occupation force fulfilling U.S. interests in Somalia. And yes, it's absolutely true that Ugandan soldiers have been selling weapons to Al-Shabaab, the same movement they're supposed to be fighting against. Now, why would they do this? It is obvious that Museveni does not want this conflict to be resolved. The longer it is prolonged, the longer Museveni has an opportunity to get financial and military assistance from the United States, and the longer he can get the U.S. to shut up when it comes to issues of human rights abuse in Uganda, because Uganda can always play the Somalia blackmail card and threaten to withdraw Ugandan soldiers.
In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
And the weather for the San Francisco Bay Area, lows in the 50s tonight with highs in the mid-70s tomorrow. In the central San Joaquin Valley, lows in the 50s tonight, cloudy tomorrow with highs in the mid-70s. That's it for this evening's newscast. Thanks to Rodolyn Ginto and Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news, and to Carla West, who's at the controls. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in this evening, and happy early Martin Luther King Jr. Day to all of you. I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.